Thanks, Art. Hi, everybody. And it's great to get away from Tallahassee and get back to the real world for a change. I want to thank you very much for inviting me, and thanks for your readership of the Times. It means a lot to all of us, and we do our best to keep you informed about what's going on out there. I appeared on a television program a couple of days ago in Tallahassee, and the moderator laid down the law. He said, I want you to sort of encapsulate in two words, no more than three words, what the 2014 legislative session was about, as if you were writing a headline. I only had about 30 seconds to come up with something, and so what I came up with was this: Saving Scott. Saving Scott. Because every election year session of the Florida legislature, regardless of which party is in power, I've been covering it, the legislative sessions up there since the late 80s. So when I got there, the Democrats had the kind of dominance and control that Republicans do now. And, you know, the operating principle in any election year is to do no harm, not make too many waves. And surprisingly, though, I think the Republicans this year did make couple of waves in a couple of areas that surprise people. I'll get to in a moment. But the Republicans in the legislature realize that they've got their hands full with trying to get Rick Scott reelected. Every poll shows him trailing. Republicans are fairly, elected officials are fairly unenthusiastic about him personally. He's never really interacted well with the legislature. But he was fortunate to have this session, the last couple of years, you know, two fairly strong and capable leaders for the Republican Party, Will Weatherford in the House, Don Gates in the Senate. So, and Rick Scott goes into the session with a very short wish list, so when you have a wish list as short as he had, it's really hard to say no to the guy. He really wanted two things. He wanted a reduction in your car registration fees. That went up in 2009 when Charlie Crist was governor, because the state was in a terrible situation. They needed a lot of money very quickly, and they didn't want to raise general taxes. So they hit car and truck registration fees really hard. They also raised the cigarette tax. They raised the cost to go into a state park, lots of things. And Scott thinks he can get some mileage out of the fact that he reduced a fee that Charlie Crist raised. Not overlooking the fact that those fees wouldn't have gone up unless the Republican legislature voted for them, and many of those people are still there. So times change, the economy changes. The other thing Rick Scott wanted really strongly was he didn't want any increase in college tuition, which has become sort of a battle cry for him to not raise tuition at colleges and universities, and they didn't do that. This session went smoother for Rick Scott than last year did, and I've got a couple of explanations why. It only took 10 months, but he finally found a lieutenant governor. And he found a guy who is well-liked, not well-known to you folks perhaps in this part of the state, but well-liked by people in the legislature. His name is Carlos Lopez Cantera, young guy, energetic, served in the House of Representatives, quit the job as Miami-Dade's property appraiser, constitutional office, to be lieutenant governor. And Scott needed somebody to sort of smooth over the rough spots in dealing with legislators. They're not always the easiest people in the world to deal with. So here's where we get to the surprising elements of the session, and that is the two issues I think that are most interesting and will resonate the most with people, and you're going to hear a lot about it on the campaign trail, both deal with immigration. Will Weatherford was the driving force behind the bill to say that if you live in this state and you're going to college and you're not a U.S. citizen and your parents are not U.S. citizens and you really shouldn't be here legally, you're going to get a break on tuition. You're going to pay the same tuition that a kid who was born and raised in Live Oak pays. And some people in the legislature, in the Senate, specifically thought this is an absolutely terrible idea, the sanctioning illegal immigration. But Weatherford used his leadership really strongly. And you had a point, I wrote about this the other day in the Times, you had a point that I thought was a turning point in the session. It was the day that Rick Scott and his people decided, hey, can we get Jeb Bush behind this issue? And they got Jeb Bush and former Governor Bob Martinez from Tampa to also sign on and say, look, this is the right thing to do. Don't penalize these kids who are here through no fault of their own. And so they passed that bill. overwhelmingly in the House. It took a lot of effort to get it into the Senate because it's an interesting thing about Tallahassee politics. The Senate President, Don Gates, is from the Panhandle, strongly opposed this idea, as do a lot of his constituents. He could have said, you know what, and I've seen it happen many times over the years, and I'd love your opinions on this. I've seen Senate presidents and speakers say, you know what, as long as I'm in charge of the button and in charge of the gavel, that bill ain't coming to the floor. And he or she can use their singular power as a presiding officer to kill legislation they don't like. Well, here we get to another fascinating aspect of legislative politics and Pinellas politics, because Gates had to deal with Jack Latvala on that issue. Jack Latvala was the guy rounding up the votes, and he gets to 21, and then he gets to 22 and 23. I think the final vote was 25-12. But once you pass 21, you are in effect controlling the agenda. And it was an issue that Latvala felt very strongly about. He wants to be Senate president. Somebody else wants to be Senate president. The guy on the other side, Joe Negron, was opposed to this idea. And, you know, but the decision was made, they're going to bring this thing to the floor for a vote, and it did pass. And Rick Scott says he's going to sign it. So, of course, the other immigration issue I won't spend too much time on, but it involves a gentleman from Pinellas County named Jose Godinez Sampirio, who's not a citizen of this country, but he has a work authorization permit. He's got a Social Security card. He wants to practice law in Florida. And he can't because the Supreme Court said a federal law trumps giving non-citizens the right to practice law. The legislature changed the law, and Jose is going to get a chance to practice law. He lives in Largo. He enlisted some powerful allies again, Weatherford and others, and went door to door in the Capitol, and they passed that deal. California has already done this with similar situations. Maryland has done it. The same is true, by the way, with the in-state tuition issue I spoke about a minute ago. Rick Perry came out in favor of this idea years ago. Jeb Bush has been in favor of this idea for years. So it's taken a long time for that idea to catch on in Tallahassee. You knew it wasn't that earth-shaking a session for policy when they spent so much time debating whether to raise the speed limit, which they did. And we don't know whether Rick Scott's going to sign that bill into law or not. I get a lot of mail from readers of the Times, and the issue I got the most mail about this session was that. And mostly people thinking this is a stupid idea to raise the speed limit. But it would go from 70 to 75, mostly on stretches of highway that are now at 70. So we're talking, for example, I-75 between here and Naples would go to 75 miles an hour. AAA thinks it's a bad idea. Interestingly, almost every woman in the legislature voted against this bill, and the older a legislator was, he or she was more opposed to this bill, I found. Other sideshows of note, John Thrasher, a very powerful senator who's the chairman of Rick Scott's reelection campaign, is interested in the presidency of Florida State University. The FSU president resigned just about the time the session started. We had an amazing event happen in Tallahassee that rarely has happened in my time up there, and that is, not long after the session started, former Governor Reuben Askew died at the age of 85, and everything came to a stop in Tallahassee for the memorial service, and his body lay in state in the old Capitol. And Democrat or Republican, Reuben Askew was universally admired by people in Tallahassee as somebody who was ethical, responsible, took the responsibilities of governing extremely seriously. He had been in declining health for some time. And it had sort of a calming effect on the place. And you didn't see quite as much partisan rancor after that because Askew had, after his governing years, had become a professor at FSU and it taught at most of the universities in the state. A quick word about what the Democrats got out of this session, and then I'll let Darrell say a few things. But the Democrats, when you don't control the agenda, your voice is muffled and you can't be heard. And the Democrats file tons of bills every session, and most of them are never even debated, never mind passed. But that, oddly, could play to the Democrats' advantage on the campaign trail this fall, because the Democrats are going to go on the campaign trail and they're going to say, with their presumed nominee for governor, Charlie Crist, they're going to say, you know what? They won't listen to rational ideas in Tallahassee. They only care about special interests. They won't try to take up Medicaid expansion. They won't consider raising the minimum wage. The Democrats even came up with this idea this session. They wanted to do online voter registration, the way like 18 or 20 states do. But when we're only 15 years removed from hanging chads in Florida, Florida is not ready for online voter registration. So thanks for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Steve. And I will offer sort of a counter look to what happened in the legislature this year. Before I begin, I wanted to note that Meredith said she wanted to learn about politics, and I'm going to give her a quick education on politics. Politics comes from the ancient Greek word poly, meaning many, and tix, meaning ugly blood-sucking parasites. Now, your education is complete, Meredith. So, this is about the third or the fourth time I spoke to Tiger Bay. 3 weeks ago, I spoke to the Tampa Club. A few years ago, I spoke to the Pensacola Club. And I must say, unfortunately, I prefer the Pensacola Club. Probably has something to do with the fact that they paid me $1,500. But I want to assure you, even though you're paying me nothing, I'll make sure you get exactly what you pay for. So let me begin by looking at some political winners this session. And I think to some degree, most people would say Governor Scott, as Steve talked about, to the sense that, you know, Republicans accomplished pretty much what they wanted to try and help out Governor Scott. So his agenda was very small. I think it was a little bit bigger than Steve said, but not too much. I mean, he wanted tax relief, not only the $25 auto tag fee, but there are three sales tax holidays that were put in addition on clothes and school supplies that will take place August 1st through August 3rd, a sales tax holiday on energy-efficient appliances from September 21st to 23rd, and a 9-day sales tax holiday on hurricane supplies that will come up. He wanted increased spending for education. Now, once again, that ignores the facts that the Republicans and the governor made cuts in education in the past, but there was an increase in spending for education, and in my view, that's always a good thing. It was up about 3%, 2.9%, or $380 million overall. The in-state tuition for undocumented illegals, I think, was a big positive as well. He also wanted a freeze on university tuitions. Now, you can look at that two ways. Will Weatherford praised Governor Scott for his compassion to these students. Now, I think the choice of that words was not accidental, because a recent Quinnipiac poll found that Governor Crist, who, if you don't know, just entered, and welcome Governor Crist. If we'd known, we would have made sure Governor Scott was here. The Quinnipiac poll showed that Governor Crist had an advantage of 50 to 35% over Scott in terms of this compassion, and that's a very important requisite for voters. They're looking at somebody who can empathize with their needs, and that's where Scott is hurting. The bad side, of course, is it's hard to provide quality education when you don't have resources. Is it unique that Florida doesn't have, of its public universities, one in the top, 50? Rankings, maybe, I don't know what it is exactly, but they fare quite poorly. And I think a lot of that has to do with inadequate funding, which is not just due to Scott and the Republicans. It's been a historic factor throughout much of Florida's history. I think Will Weatherford was a winner also because he got the immigration bill passed in the face of tremendous opposition at a time where it looked like that bill was going to fail. He cobbled together a flood insurance program of private insurers, so that there are now, I think, six private insurers that can offer flood insurance. We've seen what's happened to the national flood insurance programs as the rates have jumped up. And almost, I think it's 37% of the people in that national program are Floridian. So this at least gives an alternative there. Jack Latvala from Pinellas, I think, was a winner. He, once again, was instrumental in helping to secure passage of several important bills, including the in-state tuition waiver for undocumented. And he was a Senate co-sponsor of that piece of legislation. His likely opponent for the presidency of the Senate, Joe Nigron, was on the other side of that particular issue. Policy winners, medical marijuana. Who'd have thunk that the Republicans would support marijuana in any way, shape, or form? But they passed it, and they'll make that program we have coming up much more interesting in a few weeks. Once again, on policy issues, education, I think, was a big winner just because spending is up by $380 million. Local governments also were winners. When you have an extra $1.2 billion in revenue coming into the state of Florida, it provides opportunities for legislators to pass out money to their hometown constituents. And locally, of course, we've seen some of that money coming here. Art O'Hara has $122,000 in his pocket. Not quite yet, but he's hoping to for the Louise Graham Center. The Mahaffey Center got money. All Children's Hospital got money. USF St. Pete got $10 million for a new College of Business facility. So, you know, a lot of big winners locally. Now, is that good or is that political pork, which we all know that every one of you hates pork, so you decide. Legislative losers, the big issues. No major tax reform in the state of Florida, no change in gambling policy, no expansion of Medicaid that would help insure a million Floridians. The Springs bill got very little money. Scott requested $55 million. The legislature approved $30. Child protection, Scott asked for $40 million. It got $21 million. Even in the face of a Miami Herald report that found 477 children under DCF care in the last 6 years have died. So, you know, there are some things penny-wise and pound-foolish, and this is one of those examples, I think. No increase in the minimum wage. Another loser was simply legislation. You know, there were 1,812 bills introduced this session, and 246 passed, or 14%, which means 86% of legislation dies. And by and large, that's a great thing, especially when you read the legislation. As Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman said, thank God we don't get all the government we pay for. Now, in prior sessions of the legislature, you know, they've really done some bizarre things. Two of my favorite bills passed in the past were a bill that at one point in time prohibited rats from leaving ships that were docked in Tampa Bay. And another one that made it illegal for Floridians to have sex with porcupines. Now, I'm not sure if that was to protect the porcupines from these Floridians or to protect Floridians from sex-crazed porcupines. I don't know. But so at least we didn't stoop to that level in this session. Now, if we look at the budget, which is the most important thing, and in fact the only thing that the legislature has to do, $77.1 billion, the largest budget in Florida history, $1.2 billion in extra revenues coming in, so it made the job much easier than it has been in prior years. They put $3 billion in reserve, a rainy day fund, whatever you want to call it. But the budget is not only an economic document. In my view, it's the most important political document there is because it is a reflection of political winners and losers. If you look at the spending side, who gets the benefits from government spending? It's a good indication of political clout. And who has the muscle to get things passed in the legislature. So look at where the dollars go, and it's a tremendous indication of politics as it exists at this point in Florida. On the revenue side, it's once again a portrait of winners and losers. Who pays for government services? What kind of tax structure do we have? How regressive, how progressive is the tax structure in the state of Florida? So that is another indication of political clout. You know, former Senator Russell Long has a statement that is oftentimes used to describe how many states, including Florida, and to some extent even in Pinellas County here with Greenlight Pinellas, operate with respect to tax policy. And Russell Long, who was chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, used to have this saying, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the fellow behind the tree. You know, tax somebody else, make somebody else pay for it. And to a great extent, you know, that's what's going on. We try, you know, Florida's always trying to say, well, let's increase our sales tax because tourists will pay a third of that. You know, my question to you is, if we don't have enough gumption and reason to support a sound public policy ourselves, you know, why should we make somebody else pay for it? You know, is that the kind of tax structure you want? But basically it is. We have a cobbled together tax structure that hasn't changed much over the past 50 years, and people keep talking about tax reform in one way or the other, but we're still pretty much in the same place that we were 50 years ago with respect to tax policy. We simply always increase the sales tax because it's easy to do and there's little political resistance to it, or we increase service fees on individuals because make them pay for things that in the past were free. So that's my take on the legislature. I look forward to receiving your questions, and thank you very much.
And I just want to reiterate, if Governor Crist would rise, and Wengay Newton, Councilman Newton is here. They came in late. Wengay? Okay, we have and I'm going to call the questions. So, somebody new, Dennis. I don't know if we can use.
This is a question for Steve. You described an headlock. My name is Dennis Rupel. Dennis Rupel. You described the headline that you think aptly describes the legislature. I'd like you to now give the headline that will be in the Tampa Bay Times the day after the gubernatorial election, and explain why the headline turned out to be what it was.
My historical batting average at trying to predict the outcome of elections in the state wouldn't probably qualify for the raised AA farm club, probably. You know? It's a good question. It's an obvious one. It's a fair one. And looking at the race today, you have to give a slight edge to the Democrats. Even though a lot of factors favor Republicans in off-year elections, I'll quickly tick them off. Republicans generally get their base vote out better than Democrats do. Republicans always seem to have a better absentee ballot program. Republicans seem to have a message. In this case, the Republicans are going to have a lot more money than Democrats. So usually when Charlie Crist has run for statewide office, he's the guy with the most money. That won't be the case this time. And you have the wild card factor of the role that a person who's going to be a constant presence in this campaign, but he's not here, is Barack Obama. But I think there's a question here, a lingering question of likability with Rick Scott that won't go away, and it really hasn't been addressed, and it's a problem for him.
Well, given that this is Florida, the headline probably will read, election tied, recount likely. Florida Supreme Court soon to be involved. We know the candidates. We know the strengths. We know the weaknesses of the various candidates. I mean, it seems to me, as Steve has talked about, Governor Scott suffers from this inability to connect with voters, and that is a terrible flaw for any political candidate. Voters like to vote for somebody that they like, and he hasn't been able to develop that political connection. Governor Crist excels at that, making connections with voters. His problem, if he doesn't mind me saying, but I'll say it anyway, his problem is, to me, not so much the party switch, but the fact that why should we elect him to a position that he left 4 years ago that he could have won 4 years ago to run for a position in the Senate to be the last of 100 senators? That's the question he's going to have to address.
Bill. Mr. Dunn.
Tom Dunn. It seems to me that three of the most critical issues facing Florida are, number one, health care, number two, water, and number three, the negative effects of climate change on the economy. But yet I don't see where the legislature seriously addressed any of those. So my question to you is, would it be fair to call the Florida legislature cowardly?
What was that last word? Cowardly. The legislature as an institution tends to be reactive and only look beyond the next election cycle. That's the problem. And the problem, in my judgment, is that has gotten demonstrably worse under term limits. Of the three issues you just ticked off, without a doubt, water. Legislators know we have a long-range water problem in this state. Senator David Simmons, a great legislator from Central Florida, had the Springs bill in the Senate. You've got some people with great, great minds up there, but and I've written this, and I've had people throw the newspaper in my face. I think the time has come to reevaluate in a state of 19 million people that they can get everything done in a public policy realm in 60 days. And this, by the way, is 60 days when they take a day to honor Bubba Watson, a day to honor Jimbo Fisher, and all that stuff, which is part of the political process. We all get that. But they need to spend more time focusing on these issues, and they're basically just too reactive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would agree with Steve to the degree that, you know, these are big political issues that they have avoided for one reason or another. I mean, we would like the legislature to focus in on what's important, but they're always looking at fall is just around the corner. Anything we might do might negatively impact our own political futures. But once again, leadership calls for doing the tough things at the right time. And sometimes somebody's going to have to take leadership. Now, I think the Republican Party has tried to move, whether this is short-term with Weatherford in there, looking at trying to improve its image and looking at what he calls generational poverty issues and trying to help those in need. But then the question to Weatherford and the Republicans, if that's the case, why didn't you do something to support, you know, the million plus Floridians that don't have health insurance? Why don't you expand something to them? If you don't like Medicaid, then come up with your own program to help them out if you're so concerned with generational poverty, because that's one of the key factors related to it.
In the striped shirt.
Thank you. Yeah, I can't put on my name tag, but I am a member. Kelly Kirshner. The question would be, the Sarasota Herald Tribune today has a front page article that IMG Academy got a $5 million kind of secret appropriation to build out their private facilities. Could you identify what's your top three biggest potential turkeys, perhaps similar to that Governor Scott might actually pull out of that appropriation?
The line item for the IMG Academy, which is a privately run, privately owned sports, mega sports facility, was maybe a secret to their readers, but it was not a secret in Tallahassee. It was championed by a well-liked senator named Bill Galvano, who's a Republican, part of leadership. And you've hit on something. I don't have the other two in my mind at the moment. There are hundreds, and it's a point I'm glad you raised because I forgot to bring it up when I spoke before. Rick Scott, and only Rick Scott, has it within his power to eliminate and reduce this pork barrel spending. And will he do it? I'm going to hazard a guess and say he's going to be very surgical in his approach to this budget, but a lot of that pork barrel spending is going to survive. And there's a lot of it. Now, a lot of it, you could argue, has merit. It's water projects, wastewater. It's inner-city jobs programs for kids in St. Petersburg. It's things like that. But there's plenty of money in there for aquariums and parks and all kinds of things. And we'll see about the IMG project, but it's one of many that Scott is going to have to look at with a fine-tooth comb.
Well, once again, off the top of my head, I couldn't come up with a list of three, unfortunately. I just haven't looked at all of the pork projects that are in that legislative item, but I would agree with Steve on this. You know, in prior years, Governor Scott has lifted that veto pen quite often, and vetoed all sorts of things in the appropriation bill. This year is different for a couple of reasons. One is the legislature bent over backwards to help the governor, and so it's unlikely that the governor then is going to sort of spit in their face and veto some of these proposals that Republicans put into the budget to bring back to their constituents. But once again, it always goes back to that issue relating to pork. You know, we hate pork everywhere else except in our own backyard. You know, Bill Young made a political career out of it for 40-plus years. He was excellent at it. That's why he was reelected so often. But, you know, if we're serious about maintaining our own principles, then we've got to take a strong stance and say, no, let's veto all of these things out of the appropriation bill.
Ann.
Ann McMullen, thank you so much for being here. My question is for both of you, write the article if Charlie Crist had been governor this past session, or write the article for next session if he wins the gubernatorial seat.
Well, interestingly, you're kind of reading my mind, because that's a subject of intense discussion and speculation in Tallahassee, is what would have happened. I hope I'm not misinterpreting your question. What would have happened had Charlie Crist stayed put? We'd be a dramatically different state in a lot of ways. I can't predict with 100% accuracy, but for example, Alex Sink would still be the CFO. Charlie Crist would be, at this point, finishing his second term. If you agree with my premise, and here it is, that the economic recovery we've seen in Florida a governor, regardless of who the governor is. I'd be saying this if Charlie Crist or Jeb Bush were governor. The governor has very little to do with that. We are carried along on a river of national and world economic indicators and trends, in my judgment. Now, there are some peculiarities with Florida with our reliance on construction and the sales tax and so forth. But Charlie Crist would be right now riding high because the economy is doing so well, and Republicans, as you can see, are desperate for really strong, other than Jeb Bush, strong presidential candidates. That's my take on it.
Well, I think if Charlie had run 4 years ago, which I wish he had done, we would have had a quite different legislative session. The Republicans obviously wouldn't be saying the kinds of things they're saying about Governor Crist. And Governor Crist did have some very positive moderating effects on the party, I think, with respect to race relation issues, voting rights questions, extending the right to vote. I think some of these attempts that Governor Scott has tried to institute to purge the list of fraudulent voters when there's been little evidence of voter fraud there simply would not have taken place. If Governor Scott wins this election this fall, then you're looking for a very interesting time for the next 4 years in Tallahassee, because he's going to deal with a legislature that's likely to be 60% Republican in both the Florida House and the Senate. And you're looking at how much influence he can have then as a Democratic governor dealing with an overwhelmingly Republican legislature.
Dr. Paulson, are you suggesting that a state income tax is a better way to determine the state of Florida budget?
I've been called stupid often, but we all know what's going to happen with the Florida income tax. It's not going to go anywhere. But I would say if you look at our tax structure, and I taught Florida politics for 35 years, I taught budgeting as well. I know the tax structures used by local communities. I know the tax structure used by the state of Florida. By and large, it leads much more to regressive tax policies than progressive tax policies. Why? Because it's politically easier to do it. Because you're taxing the people who are not likely to engage in politics to a great extent. And so you go the easiest route. Or you increase user fees. You don't call them taxes, you call them user fees. But it's a burden much more on low-income families. So we need to do something to make the tax structure much more progressive, and you can start with the sales tax and all of the exemptions that exist.
Kim.
Regarding the education spending, you mentioned that $3 billion was added to the reserves. And we hear coming out of Tallahassee through this session, the message has been record spending for education. But the truth of the matter is, even with the increase of $176 per pupil, we're still $189 per pupil short from 2007 to 2008, when it seemed that public education was valued. So with the mandates under Senate Bill 736 and the increased accountability for schools and students, how do they justify this message to parents that this is record wins for public education?
Well, yeah, it's, as we've pointed out in the newspaper many times, both in the news pages and the editorial side, that's spin. It's not a record. It's a record in this sense. It's the most bottom line, the biggest bottom line number, but the K through 12 student population in the state rises year after year after year. In addition to those mandates, they also put a lot. You don't see school superintendents jumping for joy over this budget, and that's one of the indicators. Again, Rick Scott wanted, and the legislative leadership wanted, every governor wants this in an election. They wanted something that was bumper sticker proof, I would say, which is I cut taxes and fees. He could have left those auto tag fees alone and put $1 billion into public education. I think $1 billion sounds better than $542 million. Education, support for public education is the only issue that, from what I've heard in 30 years of reporting in the state, it blows every other issue away in terms of its unassailable popularity with voters regardless of their political persuasion. You can never do enough to support public schools in the state.
Well, let me just say very quickly, if you look at per dollar per student expenditures, we're about $200 less right now, even with this $380 million increase in educational spending. About $200 less per student now than we were back in 2008. But if we go back to 2008, we also might remember what happened. You know, the country, the state of Florida, went through a major recession. And any time that happens, everything gets cut, including education, as much as you may not like it. Now, it may get cut more than you want, or it may get cut proportionally greater than you think it should. But that is in part the explanation for what happened and one of the reasons why the increases are being put back in at this point in time. But Steve is absolutely right. You talk about education, whether Republican or Democrat, and everyone starts paying attention in a room.
Beverly Midland, I need a civics lesson, Jerry, and thank you for coming. I would like to know, what is it going to take for someone like our young lawyer who just passed the bar and can't practice but would like to practice with a special law? What's it going to take for him to become a citizen and others like him?
I've written about Jose's case many, many times, and from him and from his lawyer, the federal immigration laws of this state require him to first return to his native country and establish residency there and then apply to come back into the country. He's not going to do that. He came here at the age of 9 years old. I mean, this is the most obvious statement Darrell or I will make all day, but the fact that the immigration policy in this country is broken. It's the job of the Florida legislature to do a lot of things, but it's not the job of the Florida legislature to set immigration policy. It really isn't. That's why what they did was far-reaching. And to your question before, sir, about my comment about the short-sightedness, I thought in this case they showed some foresight because we are not only a nation of immigrants. Look at this state. This is the most diverse state in the United States. So citizenship is a long way away for Jose, if ever, is the answer to your question, ma'am.
With respect to immigration, there are always, you know, two sides to that particular coin. And Steve's absolutely right. You know, in this case, you know, is it fair to hold somebody accountable for the sins of our fathers or sins of our parents, so to speak? And most people would say no. You know, he was brought here by his parents. You know, he didn't ask, "Mommy, can I go to the United States today?" You know, his parents brought them here for the same reason that immigrants come to this country. So to a great extent, I think the Democrats are right on that particular issue. You need to show compassion to these individuals who got here through no choice of their own. On the other hand, I think Republicans are right with respect that something needs to be done about the immigration situation and the porous borders, or else this will continue to happen and the problem will continue to fester up in American society. So we've seen, you know, and oftentimes Republicans will point to, you know, Reagan backed away and allowed illegals in and they sped up the process for them. And then people say, well, the borders just opened up again because people saw they got away with it. So compromise needs to be reached on that issue.
Jim?
Jim Gillespie, I'd like you to do role reversal. I would like Mr. Biscay to make his 2-minute presentation for the election of Governor Crist, and I would like Mr. Paulson to make his 2-minute election for Governor Scott. Or let's reverse that, because that's too easy. I would like you to do Governor Scott and Dr. Paulson to do Governor Crist. You have deep political knowledge. Conjure up the best arguments.
Sure. Mr. President, you may have 2 minutes each. It was 1 minute.
Two.
Fine.
Here's the case for Rick Scott's reelection. It's not that difficult to make. Under his leadership, a lot more people are working than were working when he took over. People feel better about themselves and about this state. There is more money being put into public education than there was before. Again, that can be qualified. He is a again, it's your vision of what the kind of place Florida is comes into play here, but he is a guy who generally believes in low taxes, less regulation, and unfettered private enterprise to the greatest extent possible. And that is a message that will resonate very positively with a lot of people in Florida. And, you know, under Rick Scott, we've had some serious, serious problems with the Department of Children and Families and things like that. But I think he can begin to make a case that they're confronting those problems and they're trying to make things better. The guy he just appointed to run DCF after a lot of problems is a Tampa Bay guy named Mike Carroll, who's well respected. And I think that's the case right there. That things, if you have a moment in a debate between Rick Scott and Charlie Crist, Rick Scott's the guy who's going to say, you know what, you are better off than you were 4 years ago because of me. That's the answer.
Well, it's also easy to make the case for Governor Crist. You know, we have a record for Governor Crist. We know that he's got tremendous knowledge of the state of Florida and its public policies. He's been a former state senator. He's been the education commissioner for the state of Florida. He's been the attorney general for the state of Florida, served as the governor for the state of Florida. So he's got vast experience in all sorts of different aspects of Florida politics. He knows how the system works, and he knows how to get things done. He also has this great ability to make connections with the voters and to listen to them and to hear what they're saying, a fact that many politicians, or a skill that many politicians simply lack. It's not just saying hello to you, but listening to you, talking to you. Anybody who's met Charlie Crist knows that if you meet him once, you know, he'll see you 10 years later, and he'll talk to you by first name basis. He's got uncanny political skills, and that's a great political asset for anybody. He was, I think, a very positive, moderating effect on the Republican Party with respect to racial issues, especially as it related to blacks, as I previously mentioned. You know, there was the election, I think it was 2010, where there were long lines in Florida at several polls, and Crist extended the hours to allow those people to vote. A lot of Republicans objected to that. You know, there's nothing more sacred than the right to vote. I don't think you would have seen Governor Crist, as you have seen Governor Scott, trying to institute policies to limit, once again, fraudulent voting by individuals by going after, you know, suspect citizens. And in fact, at the end of this month, I'm testifying in Tallahassee in federal district court on another voting rights case. And even though I'm retired, I thank God for the Florida legislature and its foolishness because they keep me gainfully employed oftentimes. Even as a conservative from the Heritage Foundation, hired by the NAACP to defend voting rights in the state of Florida, because I can think of nothing more conservative nor more liberal than defending the right to vote of all Floridians, and Governor Scott has done that.
Governor Crist, sorry.
Yeah, we knew it.
Harvey.
Harvey Landers. Governor Crist recently has come out in favor of normalizing relations with Cuba. Good move or bad move?
Sure. My answer to that is good move, but maybe a little hasty. We're going to find out. Because it's going to, that's an issue that if you're not, if you don't feel passionate about a dictatorship in Cuba, then you think, gee whiz, hasn't that time arrived to have more of a hemispheric view of things? I mean, look how close they are to us. But a photograph of a Democratic candidate for governor cozying up or appearing to cozy up to a Marxist dictator could have a devastating effect in the November election in this state. It really could. And so that's why we've all, especially the young man in the back there with the white mane of hair, we all know about the hug. I mean, this would be the hug. This could be the hug times 100. Having said that, and I don't have any data to back this up, just my intuition and my journalistic expertise, younger Hispanic voters, many of them, feel strongly that the time has come to do something like this. The Orlando Chamber of Commerce just made a trip to Cuba. I mean, this is not an outlandish idea anymore. It's becoming more and more mainstream in our country, I think.
I saw Governor Crist jotting down the note, do not hug Fidel. So, but yeah, the question is it the right timing? Timing is often a critical element in politics. It is something that entertains great risk, quite frankly. And I would agree with Steve on this. I'm not sure it's the right time to do this. Now, when you look at Hispanics in Florida, you know, we know they're gravitating towards the Democrats. We know if you look at recent registration over the past 4 years, Hispanics are overwhelmingly registering as Democrats, not Republicans. We oftentimes make the mistake in Florida that when you're talking Hispanics, you're talking Cuban Hispanics. But even among Cuban Hispanics, you know, the old generation are Republican, the new generation are much more Democratic in their outlook. And those Hispanics who come from Mexico, who come from South America, you've got this great diversity of the Hispanic population, and you can't just assume that you're going to win them over. So I think it's, you know, if I was Chris, I wouldn't do it, quite frankly.
Linda.
This is not a partisan question, but a reasonable, rational one. What record may Governor Scott say that the $25 saving for the car registration would help Floridians buy a car or house? And what is even more wrong with his advisors, who are saving Scott, to let him say it many times? It's beyond me.
I get it, and here's the answer, and that is nothing a candidate of that level does like that is done without it being either poll-tested or focus-grouped or both. Here's the thing. The dilemma the Republicans have is being accused with some justification of being more concerned with corporations and wealthy people than with the average guy on the street. How do you fix that? How do you fix that image, even if you believe that image is totally wrong about Republicans? I would say that it's an image that a lot of people have, and I think a lot of Republican legislators would say that's our biggest problem. How do you fix that? Well, here's one way to fix it. You come up with an idea of a cutting taxes or fees that it has universal appeal in the state. It's not much money, but it affects almost everybody in the state. I've done the stories about how if you renew your registration for 2 years, you don't get the break on this thing. There's a lot of holes in this thing, and it really isn't a hell of a lot of money. I mean, it'd be one thing if it was $25,000 for every motorist, but it's $25. It's two pizzas, okay? That's what it is. But you're gonna hear about it from now to November.
Well, as a pizza eater, what's wrong with that? But I mean, how you sell your political issue is terribly important, and I think Scott and Republicans are going to spend a lot more time not talking about $25. But talking about a $500 million tax cut, putting money back into the pockets of Floridians. That's the way you sell it. You know, it's somewhat counter to what we do here locally in Pinellas County, a penny for Pinellas, it's only a penny. Well, that penny generates $1.2 billion every 10 years. I mean, if you're opposed to that, and I'm not a great supporter, quite frankly, as you might gather, that $1.2 billion is a heck of a tax increase. But nobody sells it as a $1.2 billion tax increase. It's only a penny. So how you sell it, tremendously important.
Young Tiger.
Lorenzo and Harris and I have come up with a joint question. Education is a topic that has been explored here. However, my question is, why should the future leaders and citizens of Florida enter into the world struggling with debt to finance college, even with Brett Petrie, which has decreased every year and added tighter restrictions? What could be done to help students like us?
Good question. And incidentally, are you the young man who's going to major in history at Florida State? Well, good for you. Congratulations. I know a little bit about that subject. I've got a master's in history from Florida State University, and it's a great program. It's a great place. The question was about the staggering amount of debt. And by the way, a piece came out, was in the Washington Post, quoting the National Conference of State Legislatures. We're one of the worst states with college debt of kids. Of any state. The answer is for this state to get everything hinges together. Professor Paulson talked about the problems with the tax structure in the state historically. I couldn't agree with him more. I've covered the tax structure for 30 years. They need other sources of revenue to greatly expand student financial aid and student working opportunities for kids like yourself. That's the quickest way to resolve that. But, you know, and as right now the mantra in the state politically is don't raise tuition. Okay, well, that sounds like it's okay, but, you know, the presidents of the universities would like the flexibility to raise tuition so that they could have more revenue to work with and maybe hire more professors and have fewer adjuncts and so forth. I'll defer to the professor here.
No, when you said this was going to be a joint question, I assumed it was going to be on marijuana. So, especially from a younger person. I mean, gee. You know, it's all relative. When you look at tuition in Florida, Florida has consistently been on the very bottom of the 50 states in terms of student tuition. So I imagine if you ask a student from New York or Illinois or California or many other states, they would look at tuition that is paid in the state of Florida for undergraduate education and say, oh, my God, if our tuition was only that low. Because we are. Traditionally, we're 48th, 49th, 50th in terms of student tuition rates. So in many respects, it's hard to say, you know, what else can the state do? And, you know, it can't lower per student spending anymore if you're going to have quality education. So, you know, the only way they can do it is, once again, diversify the tax structure to bring in extra dollars to provide more money for students in need and do it on a needs basis, not on the basis of test scores.
This is now the last question, so.
Yeah.
Oh, she beat you. Sorry, Greg.
Okay, Betty Morgan, Steve. I'd like you both to comment on what's going to be happening with the three judges, if the Supreme Court's Florida judges. In terms of this weird kind of appointment process that's going on.
Okay. There are four, not three, it's four members of the Florida Supreme Court, of which there are only seven justices, seven people. This gets to the point of, and you all have your own opinions, but this gets to the point of why elections for governor really do matter in the state, because those folks are there till 70 and beyond. The terms of four Supreme Court justices, by coincidence, will expire on the same day that the governor is due to be sworn into office, not this election, not this one, the one after this one. It's January something of 2019, first week of January 2019. But, and, you know, they're trying to create a mechanism, the legislature did, whereby the governor who's going out of office could make those appointments, not the governor who's coming in. Well, we don't know who the governor is going to be in 2018 yet, do we? So the Republicans claim they're not trying to favor anyone, but they are trying to favor, think they're favoring the Republicans. But here's the catch. This idea needs 60% of the approval of voters in November. This is on the ballot. They didn't do this with a wave of their hand. This is something the voters must have a say in. And because we're one of two or three states in the country that requires a supermajority on any constitutional amendment, 60% of the voters will have to go along with this. There is going to be a campaign against this ballot initiative. You can bet on it.
Well, I'll give a very short answer to that. And I think both parties oftentimes do things when they see the future and they don't like what the tea leaves say. And Republicans are concerned that they perhaps will not be in political control, so let's change the rule. But these things always come back to bite you in the ass. At some point in time, the Democrats are going to be in control, and then they'll have a situation where they'll make three or four judicial appointments, and Republicans will be saying that's unfair. So I just don't see the virtue of this kind of proposal.
I'm going to do one more question.
My question for both speakers. To paraphrase Dr. Paulson, I have a joint question about marijuana. The recently passed legislation on legalizing medical marijuana, I'd like to have your comments regarding the impact of the state of Florida.
The recently passed legislation on medical marijuana is to allow the drug and THC to be used in a very narrowly prescribed way under close medical supervision for mostly for children who have various forms of epilepsy. I'm one of seven kids from a working class family in Rhode Island. I have a younger sister who's had grand mal epilepsy her whole life. It's a difficult thing to deal with. And this was another example of something that if you would have asked me on the opening day of the session, this thing has no chance of passing. But this is why politics is fascinating and why sometimes really good things happen. The champion of this issue is Matt Gaetz, the son of the Senate president, one of the most conservative people in the legislature. But because he is such a hardliner on criminal justice, he began to champion this issue because his mother, Vicki Gaetz, who's had complex medical issues in her life as well, who is a really well-liked person, she said, "This makes sense. Why don't we help these kids?" And when Matt Gaetz got behind this issue, it was unstoppable because he has an unassailable track record that he's not a wild-eyed liberal. He's just the opposite politically. So, you know, no good idea is going to pass Tallahassee without a lot of Republican support, and this was one.
Okay, there are a couple of aspects to this. Now, the Florida law is much more restricted than the laws that were recently passed in Colorado, for example, which basically allowed, you know, the street sale to casual users of marijuana. This is strictly a medical marijuana procedure. There's some specific regulations in terms of access, and I have no problems with that, quite frankly. But the other side is the political coin, too. Of course, this is pushed, as we know, by Morgan & Morgan, the law firm that Charlie worked for. Is this a political gambit to get younger voters out and vote on the election day? And there's some interesting studies on this. 528, the Nate Silver guy who predicts the election in the past, has come out with a study on marijuana referendums in the state. And he looked at 14 marijuana issues since 1998. And found that among 18 to 29-year-old voters, turnout in those marijuana referenda questions was down 0.2%. So if Democrats are hoping that this stimulates younger voters to turn out, they may be surprised.
Thank you very much. Okay.
I'm going to pick up where Darrell left off and mention one word. If I had to pick one word that's going to be the most telling for the November election, the word is turnout. Turnout. Florida voters don't show up in off-year elections, and the ones who don't show up the most tend to be Democrats who live in Southeast Florida. During the week of Passover and Easter, my editor at the time said, "No, there's not much going on in Tallahassee. Get out of there." And instead of taking the week off, I went to Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami. I worked for many years as a reporter in South Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, and Miami. And I met with a lot of Democratic voters to get a sense of how they feel about Charlie Crist. And there's been written about an enthusiasm gap among Democrats, you know, that the Democrats, they don't feel really good about Obama right now. The foreign situation is very unsettled with the Ukraine and this stuff, and maybe he's not, you know, showing enough hands-on leadership, and they don't really maybe they don't feel really enthusiastic about a guy who used to be a Republican as their standard bearer. Well, what I found was enthusiasm. I wouldn't call it overwhelming, but positive enthusiasm. But mostly, what I found was, and these were older voters who live in the condos of Palm Beach and Broward County, and a lot of women voters. They're sick of losing. Democrats in the state are sick of losing elections, and they really haven't had a Democratic candidate since Lawton Shiles, in my judgment, who the average Democratic voter says, "Hey, I know that guy. I know who that guy is." They didn't really feel that about Buddy McKay or Bill McBride or Jim Davis or Alex Sink. In fact, they said of Alex Sink, "Who's he?" They did. They did. They did, and that's a fact. And so that tells you all you need to know about what Democrats have been doing wrong in these last elections. And now, having said that, you know, Alex Sink was outspent tremendously. She didn't run a very good campaign. It was a terrible year for Democrats, and she almost won. So that's why this is going to be a great election this season. Thanks for the question. Very good.
Well, let's get back to drugs. let me just say a couple of things about medical marijuana, because this is coming up for the vote in the fall. It's going to take a 60% vote, just like the amendment that Steve was talking about. And even though the polls indicate right now that better than 70% of Floridians favor that proposal, it's not a sure thing. because the opposition is forming. You know, we will have a Tiger Bay in a couple of weeks. A spokesman for the opposite side, Drug-Free Florida, which Mel Sembler, local businessman financier, just put $100,000 into that proposal, has indicated he's willing to put much more into that proposal. So there may be the Morgan & Morgan versus Mel Sembler contest going on. So that will be a very interesting political battle. A couple of other things. One thing we didn't mention is the legislature did pass a proposal to change session dates in 2016. You know, there is a provision of the Florida Constitution that in even number of years, the session must be in March and April. But it doesn't say anything about, in odd numbers of years, it must be in March and April, but it doesn't say anything about even number of years. So in 2016, they're actually moving the session to January and February. Now, the question remains, as Steve alluded to, is 60 days enough to do the business of a megastate? Because by 2016, Florida will be the third largest state in the nation. Can we do our business? Now, there are a lot of conservatives, a lot of Republicans who say the fact that we have a 60-day session is a blessing. Lock the doors and get them out of Tallahassee. Because the more laws they pass, the worse off we all are. But it is a real issue. You know, can you deal with all of the issues of a megastate like Florida in that particular time period? One thing I would say about the Republicans, you know, they did attempt this session to try and soften their image in many respects, a more compassionate kind of image. They have to do that. You know, before the session began, the Tampa Bay Times wrote a piece, "If Governor Rick Scott Only Had a Heart," and they talked about some of his deficiencies. And I'm not going to have time to talk about them, but Rick Scott needs a heart. Okay, thank you.
There are mugs in front of you. Corrupt politician. And you're close to being politicians, so, and you both did have a role today, so thank you very much. And we have a winner. But first off, I want to remind everybody that May 21st is What's New with Political Polling Nationally, presented by Drew Gold. With the St. Louis University Polling Institute, and it'll be here at the Yacht Club. This winner is no stranger to the fang and claw, Jim Gillespie.